will now ask Dr. Heckman here to introduce our speaker.
It's my pleasure to have John Rice visiting and to introduce him to all of you. A little history, he got his bachelor's at University of North Carolina, PhD at Berkeley, and he was a faculty member at UC San Diego for a while until going back to Berkeley, but this time as a faculty member in 1991. He's the chair of the statistics department there now. He's an ASA fellow and an IMS fellow, served as editor of Annals of Statistics. His research program has always been stimulated by applications in a wide variety of areas, and lately these applications have involved large data sets. One of these you'll hear about today. Another one has to do with astronomical data from large-scale surveys. So, John.
Okay, maybe I should get these lights here. Is that too dark? Is that better? It might be easier to see. Okay, well, I want to thank you all for inviting me here. It's really a wonderful place and really wonderful university and a great time of year to be here. It's nice also to be in this nice peaceful setting and away from the traffic system in the Bay Area. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about some aspects of a project that's involved a large group of people at UC Berkeley. And this involves people in EECS, including Stuart Russell, whose interest is in artificial intelligence, Jitendra Malik, who's interested in computer vision, Alistair Sinclair, who is interested in probabilistic analysis of algorithms, Praveen Varaya, whose background is in control theory but has very wide interests. I'll mention that Chao Chen is responsible for a lot of what we're going to see here. In statistics, as Peter Bickel, myself, a graduate student, Xiaoyang Zhang, Jiamyun Kuang, and Eric Van Swet, who also played a role in some aspects of what I'm going to be talking about, and their faculty also and postdocs in transportation engineering. So, as you'll see, it's kind of a large, multifaceted project, and one of the really enjoyable things in working in it has been the contact with this group of people with all these specialities of expertise, both the faculty and the graduate students, and I should mention some undergraduates also who worked on the project with us. So let me give an outline of the talk. I first want to give a little overview of the kinds of issues and the kinds of data that we are concerned with and will be concerned with. This will be fairly broad brush. Then I'll go on to talking about a particular project called the Freeway Performance Measurement System, which will be at the base of the heart of the talk. And the problem that we'll be interested in with respect to this freeway performance measurement system is predicting travel times on urban freeways. So most of the talk after a little bit will focus in on this area of how can you predict travel times on urban freeways. Before I get into that, I'll talk about, of course, the source of the data. The sensors that are used are called loop detectors. I'll tell you a little bit about loop detectors. Discuss what the problem is, some approaches we've taken, and then finally come in on a very simple procedure and some examples. Okay, please feel free to interrupt with questions as we go along. It actually makes it a bit more lively for me. So projects. So one of the projects that we have going is something called the Berkeley Highway Laboratory. Some of you have probably been in the San Francisco Bay Area. Interstate 80 comes in from the east, comes through Richmond, and then is coming south here to Oakland and San Francisco. And about here, there's a branch that takes you on the Bay Bridge over to San Francisco. This is a very heavily used used escape route from San Francisco, and also very heavily, a lot of traffic coming in there in the morning as well. There's a very tall, ugly building called Emeryville Towers, or Pacific Park Plaza, which sits here. It's about, well, you can kind of get an idea of the height of it from this picture down here. It's maybe 12, 15 stories tall. And what we've done is to put a bank of cameras on the top of this. And what we'll be doing, I'll show you in a minute, is these cameras are filming traffic flowing on Interstate 80 down below. So that's the primary reason for this particular installation, is to use these cameras for reasons I'll talk a little bit about. There are also other sensors, loop detectors, which I'll tell you about, at these stations along the way. And another aspect of the project has to do with integrating the information from the loop sensors with the much higher content video data. Okay, so here's a little movie I'm going to show you about what the view looks like. But first, before I begin it, what we're doing is we're looking progressively further north. So in this panel, you see what a camera sees looking straight, more or less straight down. This is a view from another camera, which is looking in, up a little bit more in this direction. And finally, this camera is focused further upstream. So let me start this while I'm talking. This is, we don't really drive this fast in California.
Oh, yeah?
And, you know, if you, sometimes you can spot, if you're really fast, a truck like that one there, and there it goes over there. So sometimes you can pick up a vehicle moving from one camera to another camera to the next camera. And one of the sort of interesting problems here is how do you do this statistically? How do you hand off the data? What we want to do, oh, I want to point out something else, too, to watch for. There's a merge here. This lane disappears at this point. And what you'll see later on while I'm talking is traffic backing up here and producing sort of a wave that goes back upstream and propagates into this panel here. Many of you have experienced these kinds of waves while you've been driving. From the standpoint of an individual driver, it's always a little mysterious. You're driving along just fine, and then all of a sudden, things come to kind of a crunching halt, and you pick up speed, and you never see what the problem was at all. By the time you get there, it's presumably dissipated. Why are we doing this? Well, I think it probably will produce some of America's funniest home videos. If you I mean, there's some fantastic drivers you see out here. But more seriously, so now we see a little shockwave building up here, pushing back in here. There are a couple of reasons. One is that there is a general interest in surveillance of traffic with cameras in order to provide information on the state of freeways. How you do that's not completely straightforward. These are videotapes we're seeing here. What we want to do is convert them basically into vehicles. That means that the camera, or the data from the videotape has to be digitized and represented as a pixel array or a movie. And then you've got to pick out what a car is. At this point, it's easy for us to actually look at that and say, oh, that's a car, it's moving. It's much harder to get a computer to look through a sequence of frames and to spot cars and to say, oh, I just saw that car, this truck there. So there it is over there. So the trucks are easy, but some of the other vehicles are pretty hard to do. So there's interest sort of basically in trying to develop methodology for tracking and identifying individual vehicles under varying circumstances. You could have rain, for example. Lighting conditions vary a lot, so shadows cause a lot of problems if the sun's very shallow in the sky. Here, occlusion is not so much of a problem because we're looking from above, but an angle, a camera lower down can suffer from one vehicle occluding another one. One of the principal reasons for doing this is to try to validate computer micro models. There are a whole family of models, microscopic models for how people drive. And basically what you do is you tell one of the models, we've got a certain inflow in some sources, and the sources are going to some sink, and there's sort of rates coming into these sources, and each little guy arrive in an automobile, and he's kind of assigned some random parameters about how aggressive he is, for example, how close he happens to follow, where he's going to exit, how aggressive he is at changing lanes, what his reaction time is, and et cetera. So they assign these parameters to drivers, and then they drive on this sort of virtual freeway. One of the reasons for doing that is in city planning exercises. People wonder, well, what if you were to put an additional shopping mall in, or to create an exit somewhere, or move, destroy a lane, or create an extra lane? In order to make predictions, people often resort to these computer models. But very little is really known closely about how well these computer models really do, because it's hard to come up with data to validate them. So I mean, people fit them. A group in Singapore worked very hard at fitting them. They said they got a good fit to data using genetic algorithms. However, their drivers had reaction times which sort of far exceeded those of the best Olympic athletes in the. Okay, so enough. So this is, I won't be talking more about this project, but this is sort of something that's coming in the future. What I'll be mostly talking about is the Freeway Performance Measurement Project. This is data from this network of freeways in Los Angeles. To give you an idea of scale, from here out to about here is around 50 miles or so. We have data coming in real time from these freeways. Updates every 5 minutes, and I'll tell you in a bit about where that data is coming from. But that data enables you roughly to characterize the state of the freeways. So what I've got here is a little fast forward on one morning. It's now 8:35. I'm sure you can't see this at the back. I'll tell you, it's 8:55. Now it's 9. Okay, now we're back to 7 a.m. So you sort of watch the traffic build up. And you can watch, for example, if you look here, you see backflow, the congestion on Interstate 10 heading east backs traffic up well into Santa Monica, which is in this area in here. So if you're a driver, however, I mean, what you would do is to make an inquiry at this website, which I'll show you in a minute, and it will bring up a map like this with real-time information about what the state of the freeway system is. As well as for the sort of instantaneous use by drivers, a huge amount of data is being archived through this, and people, traffic engineers, for example, find it a rich source of information which may be lead to useful modifications. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later on. Anyhow, so here's the this isn't the website itself, actually. It's just a one page that I downloaded from the website some time ago. So this says speed collect data collected on 3/23/2001. So it was March 23rd. If you go to the website, this is a sort of picture you see. You see the freeway complex here, the network. There are triangles which are located on it, which are tell you where there are accidents or incidents reported by the California Highway Patrol, which are automatically posted on the website. And you get a picture of what the state of traffic is at various places, color-coded here. Now, it's actually not that easy to read. This website's attracted some attention. A couple of weeks ago, it was somebody or other's web pick of the week who said nice things about it. Then in the beginning, they said, although it is no visual feast, this. Anyway, so what you do then, what you can do is, you can click on a node and then on another node, and it will give you an estimate of how long it'll take you to go between from point A to point B. It will give you alternative routes and try to find the fastest path through this network. And for Los Angeles, because of the dense coverage of freeways, the fastest path is not always by any means the shortest path in terms of miles. So I asked it to give me information from going from here, I guess it's from here, was it here? Well, it's about down here up to here. And this was the kind of results that were returned. So you say, well, we're starting from the 405 and 710 in Long Beach to the 10 and 405 in Santa Monica. This is the time. You can say, well, it's now 9:50. You can ask. You can say, I want to leave a half an hour from now or an hour from now. How long will it take? You can say, I'd like to arrive at 11:30. When should I leave? Or should I bother to go at all? And it says, from the 405 and 710 in Long Beach, take 710 north 91 West, 110 North, 10 West, total of 30.7 miles, and the travel time is 44, predicted travel time is 44.2 minutes. So this is a route which is about 31 miles long for another route which is actually the shortest in terms of miles. The mileage is about 22 miles, and the estimated predicted time was about 67 minutes. So basically what the, and then it gives some alternative routes later. Basically the obvious way to go is like this. What the computer had you doing is going like this up to, whereas, well, it was a sort of a zigzaggy route, I forget exactly what it was. Okay, so what I'll be talking about largely in the later parts of the talk is how do we do this? That is, where are these numbers coming from? You know, predicting 41.7 minutes or whatever. Yes?
Did you build this project?
The project built it. I didn't build it. But that, actually, that's sort of saying one of the really nice things about working with this group of people is that a lot of the work that was done in putting this up, it's all in Java basically, was done by a postdoc in statistics and a graduate student in EECS. And then, you know, people had ideas and et cetera, but they really did the bulk of the work in getting this thing up. Okay, let me go back to the main part of the talk. Okay, so this data is also, this may be frightening, this data is also going to be available on cell phones. And we've got a little prototype cell phone interface, so here's somebody driving along, drinking coffee with the right hand, talking to the cell phone on the left hand. And it says, welcome to arrive on time, you know, from I-880 and SR-92 to UC Berkeley. It gives you the route on this little tiny cell phone screen which you stare at while you're driving along. And then it tells you directions, north on I-880, merge onto SR-24, etc. Says your estimated arrival time is going to be 2:48. Later on you ask for the estimated arrival time will be 3:25. Later on you can ask for an update and they'll say, well, it looks like it'll be more like 3:35. So in the future, these kinds of information devices are going to be more and more common in cars. Hopefully a lot of them will be voice controlled. For example, in really upscale BMWs, I understand, you can activate a route guidance system. Even you start your trip by say, I want to go from Irvine to Pasadena. And from this address in Irvine to this address in Pasadena, it calculates a route for you and et cetera. And then you start driving, and the car has a GPS unit in it, and it says, you're going to take a left turn in 400 meters. You should begin to get over into the left lane now. And then it says, you've now taken the left turn. You're going to take a right turn on Vancouver Street or something like that. So I don't think that the interfaces are going to be all visual by any means. That also sort of, just parenthetically mentioned, offers tremendous challenges for statistics. If you're going to query that voice and say, help, I can't get through, where am I, or something like that, it's got to be able to recognize what you're saying in a rather noisy environment. Those are very challenging computational problems, very challenging statistical problems, very challenging modeling problems. Okay, so the data that's at the heart of the freeway performance measurement system are loop detectors. Now, loop detectors, here's a picture of some loop detectors. In this case, there's a pair of them. These are loops which are literally buried in the asphalt. They have a little current running through them. So when your car goes over, it gives rise to an inductance that induces current. So you get a little pulse, which you can measure out on the side of the freeway with instrumentation. If you have two loops, you can see that you can actually read velocity directly by when the arriving edge hits. Otherwise, what's measured directly, if you only have a single bank of loops, are flow, which is the number of vehicles per unit time, or say during an hour, the number of vehicles which crossed over, and occupancy, which is the percentage of time that there was a vehicle over that loop during that period of time. Because you get to see the car arrive and you get to see it leave. Now, I think it's pretty clear that if you knew how long a car was, and you knew how long it remained over this loop, you could figure out what its velocity was. Because it stays over there a long time, it's going slowly. If it stays there a short time, it's going fast. So you can kind of impute, you can estimate velocity, and I'll say a little bit more about that. And yeah, these loops are very, very common on urban freeways. Typically, they're spaced in California, anyhow, about a half a mile or a third of a mile apart. I never saw them until I got involved with this project, and now when I drive along the freeway, I mean, you just see them. And I imagine they're sort of here, between here and the airport also. So they've been there for ages as a potential source of data, collecting data which never gets stored and has never been used, never was used, never will be used. But now with sort of modern communication technology, computers, the pressure because of the terrible traffic situations to gather information about transportation systems, there's a real push to find valuable information that's in this data and to make that information available to the public. So the website I've showed you, for example, is an attempt to use this huge source of data. The data's coming into computers and statistics and CS from around, I forget exactly, about, say, a couple thousand loops in Los Angeles every 5 minutes. And it gets updated and put on our website. Okay, so what kind of information can you get from loops? Well, these are recordings at four loops at a particular place, it doesn't make any difference where, in Los Angeles, a particular site. And these are measures of velocity. There are four different lanes here, lanes 1, 2, 3, and 4. And what you see is from 10 o'clock up to 1,400 hours, 2 o'clock, the traffic was flowing pretty well, and then the velocity just crashed and then recovered again after about 6 o'clock in the evening. So you can get these profiles of velocities. Here what I've shown is flow. Now, flow is number of vehicles per second, and it doesn't bear a one-to-one correspondence with velocity. Probably it's fairly apparent if you think about it, but I'll show you later on. The relationship between flow and velocity is not simple. We could put up a similar picture for occupancy. So this is sort of the data. This is what the data stream looks like as it's coming in. Okay, so let's talk about this picture here. This is a very fundamental picture for people in traffic. The left side is a cartoon trying to illustrate what the basic ideas are. So on this axis, I'm going to put flow, say in vehicles per hour, and this axis is going to be occupancy, the percentage of time of vehicles over that loop, which we can think about basically as density of cars on the freeway. At very low occupancies, there are no impediments to travel, and the traffic moves along at a free flow velocity. The slope of this line is proportional to velocity because of the relationship I talked about between flow and occupancy and its relationship to velocity. So as the occupancy increases, you get more cars coming on the freeway, and they're a bit more dense, but up to some point it doesn't make any difference. You have more and more cars going through, and viewed as a system, the throughput becomes better and better. It's a more efficient system. Up to some point in time, however, people are unwilling to tolerate such close following distances as you would need in order to maintain, say, 70 miles an hour, and they begin slowing down. What happens then is one begins to enter a congestion region, a regime, and the velocity begins to drop. Remember the velocity we're thinking about as being the slope of this line. So the velocity begins to drop. Even you've got more cars on the freeway, but in terms of the system performance is worse. The throughput in terms of flow is actually decreasing. So up to a certain point, you can take more and more cars, and you do better and better from a societal point of view in terms of flow, in terms of throughput. When things get sufficiently congested, however, when you reach past some kind of critical point, the velocity drops and the flow drops. So the congestion builds up, and here we have a point, depth of congestion. There's a recovery phase, sort of like a hysteresis phenomena, which takes you back to the previous flow. This is some pictures from a loop detector in L.A. Here's one trajectory. As time went on, time's running along like this. It's doing fine, lots of getting up to like 8,000 vehicles per hour. We get into congestion. It drops down to maybe 7,000 vehicles per hour, then recovers and comes back here. Another time, it looks like the critical point changed. There's a fair amount of randomness, apparently, in where it is here that things begin to go wrong. There are various sorts of theories. There have been a lot of mathematicians and physicists for years and years who've worked on mathematical models for traffic flow. It's kind of an inviting subject. So there are theories involving chaotic, you know, transition into chaotic regimes. One of the things that the video data actually might allow us to do is to look and to see if these little cellular automata models that the physicists use are actually accurate in their predictions. So one of the things you'd like to do is to keep, you'd like to stay in this to the left, you'd like to keep occupancy to the left of this point here. Okay, but in order to keep the responsiveness of the system maximally efficient. One of the ways for doing that are through what are called ramp meters. What that amounts to, in parts of California, if you want to get onto a freeway on an entrance, there's sometimes a light which either allows you to get on, or if it's red, you've got to wait until you get on the freeway. And the purpose is to keep the occupancy down so that we don't get into this regime here. Most of those are sort of set on automatic timing cycles, you know, from 8 to 8:30, it's going to be red a certain percentage of the time, green a certain percent of the time. And we're doing some experiments to link those dynamically to sensors in the roadway to sort of adaptively modify the red and green light cycle. Okay, so the previous pictures were sort of local information you'd get from a loop detector, just a loop detector sensing its immediate environment. You can put these together to make pictures. So here's a picture. This is time of day running along like this, and this is a spatial variable starting at the origin, say, and going on down the freeway. Okay. So this is a flow. This is a velocity field. Velocity is a function of space and time. On this freeway for one particular morning, from about 5:30 in the morning up to around 10 o'clock in the morning. It's coded so that red represents slow and green represents fast. Okay. So on this day, what happened was that there was congestion in about this region here at around 8 o'clock. Same thing happens over here. The region changes slightly, the nature of the congestion. Here we see the congestion again about at the same point, but substantially less. These are just different days, so differently randomly chosen days. You sort of see this is a terrible day. I mean, you did not want to be driving. This is down around Hayward in between Oakland and San Jose. This is about a 6-mile stretch, which I'll return to. You would not want to be driving there on this day. The other thing that's interesting is the sort of characteristic triangular shape or wedge shape that these contours have. What it basically amounts to is that if there's an incident or slowdown, say at this point in time, as time goes along, that slowdown projects itself back upstream. So we're seeing here are these shock waves moving upstream, and then when the waves dissipate, they dissipate from the similarly from the upstream to the downstream direction. So you can build up pictures of like this, which are quite useful for sort of seeing basically what's going on with traffic. Okay, now let me now turn to the main subject that I want to speak about, which is travel time prediction. How do we go about making these confident predictions we've got on this website? Okay, so I'll be talking about a couple of examples. The first example has to do with a six-mile stretch of Interstate 880, the same one you saw pictures of earlier, that had quite good instrumentation. And there were double loop detectors about every half to a third of a mile. They were all running. They were almost all working, with the exception which I'll mention in a minute. There were also probe vehicles, which had an average headway between them of about 7 minutes, who were just going up and down this freeway. Okay, this was done for another purpose. It was a full employment program for UC Berkeley undergraduates, basically. Anyway, they were UC Berkeley undergraduates running the probe vehicles, but the probe vehicles had GPS units or something on, so you could actually tell where they were, so you could see their trajectories of the probe vehicles. The probe vehicles also reported on accidents and things like that, and that was actually one of their main functions along this freeway. In that regard, let me say another use for this kind of information is in potentially detecting when there are accidents or some sorts of incidents which would require attention from a tow truck. That is, one would like to be able to have algorithms which say it looks like something's wrong, better send a tow truck. Not from probe vehicles, but from loop data. Yeah?
This would also be good for accident prediction. Like when you see somebody do something stupid, you got an idea to send a tow truck.
Right. The loops, though, don't really see people. They just see flow, they just see flow and occupancy and velocity. So we had this good data, and what we're interested in doing is predicting the travel times of the probe vehicles, which is close to ground truth as you can get in this game, from the data that are measured at individual loops. On the subject of data, the data were very carefully gathered. I mean, it put a lot of energy in it. It was done for another project. When we began to look at travel time prediction and looking at predicting and estimating the velocity distribution of drivers and things like that, we discovered that there were some weird things. Well, it turned out that the data from each bank of loop detectors was stored on a PC, on a disk on a PC sitting by the road, and every week they'd come out and they'd get put a new disk in. The clocks of the PCs were not synchronized with each other, however. And so it just made things like, trying to make sense of the traffic flows. Furthermore, in some places they actually crossed the lead somehow so that the flow that was supposed to be in lane 2 was actually the data from lane 3 and vice versa. So we were really fortunate to have this marvelous undergraduate student who got involved with us, working with me and a graduate student, and really cleaned all this up. I mean, she got all the clocks synchronized, figured out that the leads were crossed on the lanes, and et cetera. And it was an interesting and extremely useful data analysis project. Anyhow, so what we're trying to do is, from this sort of data, which are the data on the loop, loop detectors, I've just put like 5 days of data here to show you that different things happen on different days. From that, we want to predict the travel times of probe vehicles. Okay, so what do these travel times look like? The experiment was done over 20 days. There were a total of 364 runs during this morning period of probe vehicles, with about a 7-minute headway roughly between one probe vehicle and another. That was quite variable. So one way to display the data is the following. Look at departure time starting at 6:30 up till 9:30. And for an individual day, by putting together the data from the probe vehicles on that day, at each time of day, we could estimate how long this trip took in minutes. Okay? So the heavy line was that, actually, is that awful day I showed you earlier. Okay? And this, so it, at 7 o'clock in the morning, it took about 6 minutes. By 8 o'clock, it was taking 20 minutes to make that trip. And then by 8:30, 9 o'clock, the situation basically leveled off. So each of these curves represents like a travel time profile for that particular day. And what you'd like to do is to say, well, you know, you can observe this up till here for a given day and then make a prediction for later in the day. Okay, there again are the six of those days, just to illustrate, again, the variability from day to day. Okay, what approaches did we take? We tried a lot of things, actually. We tried to model the dynamics a bit, and I'll tell you a little bit about what we did. It's actually very tempting. It's a really interesting kind of random stochastic system with a lot of variability, a certain amount of lawfulness in it, and it's kind of tempting to try to make up a model for the velocity and how it, you know, how it changes over the time of day. We tried to use CART and neural nets without much success. I'll tell you what other procedures we tried in a minute. There are some things to keep in mind. There is a fair amount of missing data. In LA, for example, on any given day, we're only getting data from around maybe 60% of the loops. They fail for various reasons, which I don't entirely understand. Whatever you do really has to be robust to flawed data, because some of the loops don't give you accurate readings. And you want to be able to make predictions in real time in order to inform people who are visiting this website. So these are kind of constraints. Okay, so let me talk about modeling the dynamics. This was work that was primarily done by Jamyun Kwong and also by Eric Van Swet. The idea was to make up a graphical model of how this thing proceeds. We could call it either a coupled hidden Markov model or a dynamic Bayes net, depending on what sort of language. So it's a graphical model in the sort of statistical sense in which we think about graphical models as exhibiting dependencies. So the underlying nature of the freeway is characterized by a state. So at each time and at each place that we have measurements, there's a state. So we'll just think state is congested or not congested for simplicity. So the state's represented by the box here. Okay. At each point, you have a measurement. Okay, which is a measurement made by a loop detector, which is a noisy measurement of the nature of that state. So there's an arrow that goes from the state out to this circle here, which represents the measurement we take. Okay, how do the states evolve? Well, in time, we ask, how does this state depend on previous states of the system at earlier points in time? So the model says, well, look at the state where there's an arrow coming in from here, an arrow coming in from here, and an arrow coming in from here. That's saying the state here, given all the information in the entire past, only depends upon the states in the immediate upstream location, that location, and the downstream location. So it's sort of plausible. I mean, as sort of a thing to start with, there certainly is a sort of a local. The traffic flow certainly has a local character, probably global characters, but there is sort of a local character. In phenomena are transmitted locally. What happens right now to you probably doesn't depend on what's happening 10 miles downstream or whatever. These things are actually quite difficult to fit. The one-dimensional versions of them, in which we only had one row, are simple. They're called hidden Markov models. They're very fast algorithms for dealing with them. With this, the dependency spread through the whole thing, and the calculation is quite complex. You basically have to do them by some sort of Monte Carlo scheme. For example, what things very popular are called particle filters, also called sequential importance sampling. And so we tried this, but the model sort of did reproduce qualitatively the kind of phenomena you see in the data, but they didn't seem very good at predicting, and it also took a long time to fit. Also, when you want to make a prediction, in principle, it's not that bad. You estimate what the state is where you are. That's actually pretty hard. But you have different conditional probabilities of being in the state you're in given the data. And then you just simulate from you simulate from that prior at that point the prior distribution, you simulate the posterior, and you just see trajectories, and then you average over them. But it's not really given to sort of a real-time system, which is what we want. Plus, it didn't seem that accurate, but it did seem quite interesting, and I think that sort of intrinsic, I think, is something that we should like to come back to and take a harder look at. Okay, we had a couple of procedures which were based on the travel time curves. As we looked at the curve for a given day as being basically a data point. So you could do the following. You can imagine suppose we're at this point in time and we're on this curve here. Now we've seen that curve up to that point in time, and we have all our historical data. So we say, what's the nearest neighbor to that curve among all the curves we have in our historical database? So you need some sort of a metric for a nearest neighbor, and you kind of want to downweight the distant past, give more weight to the current time. You find the nearest neighbor or several nearest neighbors, and then you see, well, what happened? So this one, say, was the nearest neighbor. You know, what happened to it? That's my prediction.
What's each of the series?
Okay, this series here tells you, let's look at the dark one because it's easy to see. It says, it shows you as a function of time of day, of when you leave, how long it took you to make this journey for one day.
So that's just multiple days overlaid?
And this is just multiple days, right. This is the multiple days overlaid here. So basically you're at some point, you try to find a nearest neighbor among the set of multiple curves you have, and you make that prediction. Another procedure I don't want to talk a whole lot about is kind of based on just multivariate normal regression. So it's done in the following way. We act as if the following were true. Each of the successive points on these curves, which are high-dimensional objects, we pretend come from a multivariate normal distribution. Okay? And so that's got some big covariance matrix associated with it, because there are lots of times in which those are observed. If you want to do prediction, well, the prediction involves the inverse of the covariance matrix and et cetera. Well, you can't do that because the covariance matrices have very high dimension and there's not that many data points and they're actually singular. So you end up then approximating the covariance matrix by a low rank approximation and using that. So just sort of think like multivariate regression. That's basically what we're doing. So those didn't work too bad, as I'll show you in a bit. But what we came down to was a statistician's best friend, linear regression, after trying a lot more complicated procedures. So the idea is this. We want to predict the travel time for a trip departing at time t. This is to be used, predicted based on sensor data up to time t minus delta. So delta is like the forecast lag. We look at the following, t star t delta. This is the travel time, what the travel time would be if the current state of the freeway were to remain unchanged. Okay? That is, at time t minus delta right now, I've got velocity measurements at all the points in the freeway. And I suppose, suppose that just didn't change. It's like you froze the velocity field. How long would it take you to travel? And that's t star. And we end up doing is regressing t of t on t star. And I'll show you some pictures to illustrate that. Okay, the points here are a little small, but this is from the I-880 data. This is the travel time, and this is t star down here. Okay, and so there's a scatter of points, and actually, I think there's a point. No, there's a scatter of points here, an outlier here. And what we see is a pretty good linear relationship between the actual travel time and the sort of frozen field travel time. That's at 6:30 a.m. We do the same thing at 8:30 a.m. Again, you get sort of a linear relationship with some outliers, but basically you get a linear relationship. But now the slope and the also the intercept are different. So it's like at each time of day, and for each lag delta, there is a linear regression, and we sort of have this family of those. So the model, so the formal model one ends up fitting is that the travel time t of t is equal to an intercept a, which depends on time of day and depends on the lag, with a slope beta, which again depends on the time of day and the lag, times what sort of the apparent travel time is, plus some kind of random error. Yeah?
What did you do with the outlier?
We ended up using, for the most part, we experimented a bit, but we'd be using sort of robust regression. But there's a lot more, as I'll say in a bit more, this is sort of really like in an alpha test stage, and there's a lot better things one could actually do. One of the things with the outliers, they're troublesome because you can't actually look at the data. We're doing, we'll see lots and lots and lots and lots of these regressions. You're not going to sit down and look at every scatter plot and say, oh, that's an outlier. Okay, so what we do is, how do we find these coefficients, alpha, which depends on t and delta, and beta, which depends on t and delta? Well, the idea is fairly simple. We do a linear regression, just say least squares, but we'll do it robust in the end. Say least squares, but we just use data around that time, t and delta. So we sort of discard data that are far away in t and delta by means of using a weight function and doing weighted least squares, where w, say, what we use as a Gaussian density with a standard deviation of something like 15 minutes. So it's just sort of locally weighted regression. Let me make a note. The simplest explanation of what's going on in those pictures is that it's the old story about regression to the mean. I want to make a trip, okay? If it looks really great right now, like I'm just being able to fly down there, you know that when you get on the road it's going to get worse, right? If it looks really congested and awful, it's probably not going to be a great trip, but it's probably not going to be as bad as it is right now. And that's, fathers and sons and the whole linear regression story. Okay, so these models have been called varying coefficient models. So there's a paper by Hasty and Tipshirani using this name, but I'm sure people have been doing this kind of thing, for a long time. We might, they're easy to robustify because we could just use something robust other than least squares. Missing data are handled fairly naturally. If a loop drops out, what we just do is use interpolation to predict what that velocity is over that stretch. Finally, you can fit this offline on historical data, and then what we do is we store the coefficients so that when someone queries the website, what you need is the current state of the freeway, this T star, and these coefficients which you read. And so it's very, very fast, and hopefully can handle lots of queries. Okay, let me show you some. Yes?
So when you try to make this prediction, you just give a point prediction or you give a confidence?
We want to give some notion of error, too. It's a little tricky. Well, I want to come back to that point at the end because it's a good question and something which I want to address. Okay, so let me show you some results. So first, this shows what the errors were like pooling over all times of day. This is the mean average prediction error as a percent. So it's a relative error in the estimate. If you just use the historical mean, you just say, oh, what is it on average on Thursdays at 8 o'clock in the morning? The error you make is around 10%. Here is the error as a function of delta, the lag time, by using the current state of the freeway. So for short lags, you're better off just pretending the freeway, using current information and pretending the freeway doesn't change, than you are in using the overall historical mean. However, as the lag increases, the current information becomes less and less relevant and historical. So after about 10 minutes here, the historical mean actually gives you a better approximation than than using the current state of the freeway, and then it just gets worse and worse. Here's the prediction error as a percent. by this regression method, which is effectively a linear combination of these two, estimates. So it does better up to 15, 20 minutes in advance than the historical mean does. Okay, so that's a 10%. The travel time is what about? Oh, never mind. Oh. Okay, so here's what predictions on a bad day look like. This was the actual prediction. This is what the historical mean would predict, and this is what the estimate predicted. But this is for delta equals 0. Looking further ahead in time for delta equals 20, 20 minutes before the congestion occurs, you don't actually know it's going to. The estimate's got no way of knowing it's going to occur, except that in some sense it has some notion that on the average things get worse 20 minutes from now because of time of day. And it lags the current state of the freeway. This looks at the error as a function of departure time in terms of percent. So for the most part, so this is the average error, or median error, actually, as a function of departure time. The dotted lines are the 25th and 75th percentiles, and the outliers are shown by the extreme points here. So looking at the band here, there's no obvious sort of bias in the procedure. It hovers around zero, and for the most part, the prediction error is on the order of 5% or so, and it doesn't change very much over time of day. Okay, let me move on a little bit. Actually, I'm going to go on because I want to get to the next one. Okay, so we did a lot of work on looking at how well this worked. This is a very well-controlled situation. Good instrumentation, probe vehicles, good data after it was cleaned up, and et cetera. But it was a very short stretch. It was only 6 miles, and it's not really of that great an interest to predict what's going to happen over a six-mile stretch. It's things like what's going on in L.A., which are a lot more interesting practically and a lot more challenging. So we looked at predicting travel times from this part of Interstate 10 all the way out to, it's near Pasadena, but it's not Pasadena, I forget. And it's about a 50-mile stretch of Interstate 10. So this is a lot more challenging. Okay, this is what the velocity field on one day looked like as portrayed by the loops. So again, we have distance, our loop number 0 up to loop number 120. Time of day from 5 o'clock in the morning until almost midnight. You can see the dark regions of congestion. You can also see some other stuff going on here. You see like these horizontal bands, which correspond to loops are a little flaky. Now, some of the loops, you know they're flaky because they report a status. So if they report their status as they're bad, you know they're really bad, and so you just don't use them at all. Others, they have sort of status intermediate. You're not quite sure what to do. This bit down here, this chatter, is peculiar. Now, we don't have probe vehicles on this, so we're taking these velocity fields after we clean them up with the loops as our truth. Okay, here are the daily travel time curves from this sample of days. You see that there's a region of a curve corresponds to what it was like to travel this 50-mile stretch on a given day. The characteristic phenomena here are the morning rush hour and then the afternoon rush hour. This is going east on Interstate 10.
Week of the day are taken into account? Weekends?
Or? Well, actually, no. They should have been, probably. And we'll say more about this. These beautiful days here are like July 3rd and 4th or something. Yeah. But it's obvious. But you can see that if you do want to take day of the week into account, you can put it and other information as covariates into this. At least a framework for doing that is already set up in this regression framework. But it can take you a long time. When things are really going well, you make the trip in a little bit less, maybe like 45 minutes or something like that. On bad days, it can take you as long as 120 minutes to make this journey. And it's not uncommon for it to take an hour and a half on the return. Okay, so what do results look like? This picture shows again this relationship between the frozen field travel time, the current status travel time, and what the travel time actually is. And we have again these sorts of roughly linear relationships. And actually we've looked at a number of different freeway segments, and it's sort of remarkable. It always seemed to be this rough linear relationship. Okay, comparison and predict. This is RMS error in minutes here, okay, at lag zero as a function of time of day. If you use the historical mean, the RMS error could be as high as maybe 18 minutes. The current status does somewhat better at lag zero, and this regression method has an RMS error which is always less than 10 minutes. And often hovers around 5 minutes. I was really amazed at how good these results were. This is a long trip, remember, it's like 50 miles. Even if I'm saying leave right now, who knows what it's going to be like by the time you get to Pasadena. There's a lot of heterogeneity and a lot of variabilities. This is kind of surprising. You're actually able to do this well. This is a comparison regression method to this principal components method or the multivariate normal method I told you about and to the nearest neighbor method. Nearest neighbor actually works quite well. It's not as effective, it's not quite as good as regression, but maybe with more data it might actually be competitive or better. It's more computationally intensive, however. If your online prediction amounts to going out and looking for a nearest neighbor in R80 or something like that, it's going to be a little slow. So there are fast methods for searching. So here's predicting an hour in advance. The RMS error during the early parts of the day up to around 2 o'clock in the afternoon is still around 5 minutes, even though you're predicting and leaving and what's going to happen an hour from the current time. And the regression method gets up to an RMS error, which is still not much more than 10 minutes for a 50-mile trip during the afternoon rush hour, which can be quite extreme. The current status thing, as you'd expect, does worse now because things are going to change. Okay, historical mean, nearest neighbors, and principal components again. Okay, now I was going a little bit fast because I wanted to get to this slide before the end. Okay, so let me try to say in words what we do. We're actually interested in making predictions about travel times through this network. Everything I said so far is about predicting a travel time over some linear stretch with a given endpoint beginning. Well, what we do is basically the following. Suppose someone wants to go from here to here, or from any point to any other point, we break that trip up into little segments. We put nodes in the graph, okay, with their intersections where their choices can be made. And if I want to go, say, if I can find an example, from here to here, say, leaving now, the prediction is down the following way. It says, leaving now, we predict you're going to get there in half hour, say. Then we ask, if I were to leave here in half an hour, what is the prediction about how long it would take me to get to there? Suppose it has 15 more minutes. Okay, then that says I'm going to get there in 45 minutes. Now, if I want to go down here afterwards, the question is asked, if I were to leave here 45 minutes from now, how long do you predict it'll take me to get to here? So we paste together these linear predictions and actually in the end get quite a nonlinear system that we end up using to do this. So here's a little experiment of segmentation done over this stretch of freeway here. That's the first segment. That's the second segment. This is the mean absolute prediction, the relative prediction error as a function of delta going from around 8, 7 to 9% up to around 13%. This is still a pretty long stretch. It's about 25 miles, I think. Segmentation actually helps you a little bit, as you would expect. Because this contrasts. Why would it help you? Well, I want to go from here to here. Suppose it looks like it's congested. You predict it would take you a long time to make the journey. Well, it actually makes a difference whether the congestion is in this part or in this segment. If the congestion is in this segment, it's probably not going to clear that fast. By the time you get there, you'll probably be involved in it. If the congestion were in the second segment, there's a better chance that you will it'll have cleared up by the time you get there. So you gain a little bit in this example by segmentation, but not by a lot. Okay, let me try to finish up. Warts. Okay, so they'll play them. We don't have good ground truth data for the LA. We really need to have probe vehicles. We're using the velocity fields, which are produced by these loop detectors, which give us things like, even if they're accurate, they only give average flow of some hypothetical vehicle. And there's certainly driver-to-driver differences. Worse, there are probably biases built into them. We don't have data on exits and entrances. So we don't have data. If you make it a freeway interchange, we don't have data which tell you how long it takes to make that interchange. And that could add substantially to the trip. Anyhow, so it's probably the lack of good ground truth that's the biggest wart. I put Markovian with a question mark just to remind myself that what really surprised us about this exercise was that we have this very complicated system. We say we want to make a prediction. Well, what does our prediction end up being based on? We have all the current history we could have used leading up to the current point in time, and all we use is what's happening right now. And it seems very, very hard to improve upon that by using earlier information. So I don't mean sort of literally Markovian, but it has sort of a Markovian character. I want to add that we're certainly going to be doing parameter updates in time. You expect, for example, that the season changes, the sun rises and sets at different times. You want to sort of update parameters. Well, there are various sort of natural ways you can go about thinking about doing that. Probably more important to get some good conceptual updates in time. The more information we can get about how this is actually working, and by studying, how it's worked, even in its own little world, I think it can be improved. There's a funny question about segmentation and self-consistency, or about the whole method. There's nothing intrinsically which prevents the following from happening. I ask, how long is it going to take me to get from Seattle, here to Seattle, if I leave now? And it says, you're going to arrive at 8 o'clock in the evening. I don't know how long it is to Seattle. Then I say, ask another question. How long will it take me to get to Seattle if I leave half an hour from now? It's possible they would tell me I'd get there at 7:30 in the evening. That it's just possible there are black holes and wormholes in the L.A. freeway system, which... The situation gets even worse when you start doing the segmentation and you ask that the whole thing somehow be self-consistent, which would at least be aesthetically satisfying, and probably enforcing it would improve your statistical performance, too. We mentioned a little bit about covariates. There are sort of things like latent variables probably going on. For example, fog is a big problem. And you can kind of, sometimes you look at some of the data, it sort of looks like mixtures of linear regressions. It's probably possible to make some improvements. Finally, we mentioned joint estimation in a couple of ways. The way we're doing this now is we just take every little segment and we compute our estimates for every little segment, and we do that separately for every segment in the graph. Well, it's clear somehow that there's, even if I'm interested in this little stretch of the freeway, there's information somehow in neighboring segments which we're not using. So somehow to do that is tempting. And it certainly seems like a situation in which some kind of methods in the spirit of empirical Bayes would pay off. I mean, you're gathering an awful lot of data, accruing a lot of data over time. The segments are not exchangeable with each other, really, but then it can't be that different from each other either, on the other hand. So anyhow, so those are some of the directions we want to go in the future. Right now we're just trying to get the website running for the present. Thank you.
I've got a question based on some unfortunate recent experience. I'm from Ottawa and I drove here. And at Marathon, they decided to close the one Trans-Canada Highway for 22 hours. That isn't missing data, but it won't. It probably will blow away quite a few of these things. The other question I have is, and that's a weather data thing, I think. Mm-hmm. Canada, we've got to have a weather coherent.
Yeah.
The other thing is that I've driven the highway called Highway 402, which crosses from Canada to the U.S. at Sarnia, and I think I was the only car among several hundred multi-trailer trucks, and I suspect the loop detectors don't pick them up right. And they will change your travel times very, very highly.
Yeah, so a couple, you're absolutely right about the multi-axle vehicles. What a vehicle is becomes confusing to the loop to the loop detectors. There was another thing that you said also, which sort of touched on effective issues of robustness. And that's why I think that some robust procedures are important. We don't want that 22-hour closure to sort of figure prominently in the regressions which we're going to report.
They closed the 300-kilometer segment for 22 hours.
Weather's not so important in L.A. as it is here, but people there drive fast no matter what. But it's actually an amazing place to drive in. People are going along at 65 miles an hour with incredibly small headways. And what's even more amazing, relatively few accidents. And if you look at this thing and think, what are my chances of getting out of this alive? You know? But they're just really good drivers, too, and they have good cars also, which helps. But anyhow, where was I going? Weather is important. Rain, for example, which you can actually measure, will have an effect.
I was driving on ice that thick. Mm. And that was just before they closed it. There was no traction there.
You alluded to the BMWs with GPS locators, and Cadillacs have them now, and lots of commercial trucks have GPS locators. Is anyone affiliated with your group looking ahead to using tracking data for individual vehicles for this type of enterprise as opposed to relying on the loop detectors?
It'll be really useful to do that. Whether we can actually recruit cars to do that, it'd be nice to do that. You need sort of pretty good coverage. In other places, the situation is much more advantageous. For example, in Houston, they have a toll system. And you sort of pay by a credit card, and then you buy a little transponder which sits on your car. So when you go by the collection booth, it just ticks you off. Well, you can put those transponders anywhere. They don't have to be deducting money. And so you can actually get really good data on short trajectories of individual vehicles. But I don't think that there are not that many toll roads in L.A. also. They may not be sort of too concerned about Big Brother and things like that in Texas. But I think if you try to use this, people would think, this means that my spouse can find out where I've gone today, right?
They can also send an automatic speeding ticket.
Yeah.
Well, the GPS locators are certainly going to become exponentially more common.
Yeah.
Vehicle owners have an economic interest in them because they can be used to recover stolen vehicles. And the companies that operate the trucks have economic interest in using them. So they will be prevalent. And it occurs to me that in a way the data collection already would be somewhat simpler and more centralized than you're talking about with the loop detectors. Mm-hmm. Because, for instance, a trucking company that's got 5 or 10,000 trucks on the road is going to be mapping them already and collecting the data on them already. And likewise, I would think that all the data on all the BMWs would be located in one or two servers somewhere.
Yeah, no, that's really a good point. So the situation might really change over a period of 5 years. But I think that, or shorter, but I still think that one nice thing about this very simple approach is it doesn't depend inherently upon having data from loop detectors. All it says basically is, I want to make an estimate, a prediction about how long it's going to take me, and all it says is, what's the current status travel time? Okay, and that information about what the current status travel time is could come from various kinds of sensors and not necessarily loop detectors.
The transponders are not just used for toll roads, but they're used at this university to enter and exit parkades, for instance.
Oh, really?
Many of the faculty vehicles here, for instance, they have those transponders. And I would think come into use for similar purposes in many places, and I think the suggestion of having innocent, invisible transponder detectors is also a very...
I think there are you'd have to somehow address the privacy concerns. At least in California, I'm sure.
They might not have them on public vehicles. There's a transportation research group at NAMUR, led by a colleague and friend of mine named Philippe, who's an optimization. He's well known in the field of optimization because he developed the Lancelot map programming package. And they have been trying to optimize the positioning of on-demand public buses in the city of Mons.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done some work with that. And they, of course, with those vehicles, they can get the data because you're mapping a sort of minivan.
Yeah.
And then they were actually taking that data and trying to optimize at night where to place the two vehicles.
Oh, that's interesting.
So that they would do less.
Uh-huh. Well, they have something like that in San Francisco also. Muni there runs a public transportation system, and they used to have schedules. You know, bus 882 arrives at 8:20 and then gets there at 9:15. But they found that they couldn't keep the schedule, so they just put them all away. So now there are no schedules at all. But they did put GPS units on the vehicles, and you can actually inquire, you know, if you're leaving work, you can inquire where that bus is.
We have that in Ottawa.
Uh-huh.
And they don't run on schedules, they're on headways.
Somebody go.
I was just curious if there was, if you're aware of any other studies that were similar to this that have been run in the recent past.
There is some literature on travel time prediction. I can't give it to you off the top of my head, but
I know there's a city in Japan, and there's at least another American city, mm-hmm. that installed cameras on corners of streets to monitor flow rates, and that's at least 5 years old.
Yeah, people have, you know, have used cameras for some time to do things like you say, to monitor flow rates. Houston has done a fair amount, as I said before, their transponder data. The thing about loop data is it's noisy. It's not very ideal, but it's extremely prevalent.
Dense. Sounds like very dense, at least. Lots of loops.
A last comment would be that I worked for Center for Operations Excellence, which is an applied research center faculty of commerce at UDC here, and a lot of the stuff you talk about seems very similar to a project that we do for telecommunications company. Like in terms of how you model traffic, principal component analysis. Like I started to write down questions, and I realized you started to address them as we went.
Uh-huh.
And if you look at the relationship of like inter-arrival time of cars on a loop detector, if that turns out to be exponential, you've got a huge amount of history, 20, 30 years of research, let's say, on traffic models.
Mm-hmm.
And the notion of carrying capacity on trunk routes, which is the connections between switches,
mm-hmm.
your roads,
right.
Is somewhat equivalent or synonymous to your vehicles per hour,
mm-hmm.
your load.
Yeah.
And so there's some theoretical upper bounds, and there's this nonlinear relationship the hysteresis has been seen as
uh-huh.
well.
Yeah, maybe I could get some references from you later. It sounds like interesting. Interesting. I had wondered if there are parallels with other sort of networks, communication systems, but I don't know anything about that area.
You'll get relationships with packet switching networks,
uh-huh.
packets, so internet traffic, and even some of the older stuff, which
mm-hmm.
is telephone-based circuit switch stuff.
Hmm.
I'm just going to comment that the EPA has been trying to get LDD3 adopted. Onboard diagnostic system that would have a GPS monitor in each vehicle.
Oh, really?
And it would not only be providing location, but be transmitting information about 80 different sort of variables
yeah.
that are related to pollution and other things in the car. The goal was to try and eliminate all these inspection programs by essentially detecting in real time when your car became an offender and
uh-huh.
an intruder. And then you'd get a message in the mail, say, or in the telephone, saying you should report for a test. Of course, there was this huge
hassle
about that
yeah.
because of the very reasons you mentioned. But they're still pressing ahead with this OBD3 program, and so if it were adopted, I think there'd be scope for enormous amounts of data mining.
Yeah, yeah. yeah.
With that, so something to look forward to, I guess.
You can also get information from cell phones. If somebody has their cell phone on, you can find out what cell they're in. And there are real privacy concerns about that data, too.
I have a silly question. I don't drive, but I know there are speed limits. So as you travel across the road, you travel at 60 miles per hour, and then 80 and so on. And so I was wondering why you actually joined this segment of and try to predict the traveling time. Do the individual segments reflect a certain speed limit? Or,
I think that the methods have implicitly done
based on what historically goes on in one segment. And so if you're going on a trip which has two segments, you know, it looks at the relationship between current status travel time and actual travel time in the first segment. If it's a play, if it turns out to be, you know, a segment people really move fast on, maybe there are lots of lanes or something, then the method takes it into account.
And I was also wondering if there's any censoring going on, because normally you wouldn't be allowed to go beyond your speed limit, but of course in practice you do.
Censoring.
Oh, censoring.
Yeah.
No, not in principle. The data, there are lots of problems with the data. It's pretty noisy, but censoring it, there's no upper bound on it or lower bound.
I'd like to thank John for everything.